Hello, I'm David.
What can you do, David?
I can do almost anything that could possibly be asked of me. I can assist your employees. I can make your organization more efficient. I can carry out directives that my human counterparts might find distressing or unethical.
Hello, and welcome to Episode 4 of Collider's new podcast, The Collision. I'm Collider's Managing Editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me are Collider's Associate Editor, Adam Chitwood, and although Dave Trumbore is out this week, we have the good fortune to be joined by our lovely and talented contributing writer, Jason Barr. Today on the show, we'll be talking about viral campaigns, particularly relating to Fox's stellar one for Prometheus, Netflix premiering Arrested Development Season 4 all at once, and the lineup for this year's Cannes Film Festival. We'll also be talking about The Raid and the excellent Indonesian action flick has expanded to more cities and has the word redemption tacked onto the title for no good reason. And we'll finish up the episode with our recommendations. So we just listened to a brief clip for the David 8, and which is the Android model of Michael Fassbender plays an Android in Prometheus. The David 8 is his model. So they aired a fake commercial for it as part of the viral campaign. And this thing was brilliant. It just creeped me out. It was so well made. Fassbender seems, you know, he just comes off as so creepy and amazing. And I was blown away by it. Adam, what did you think about the viral clip?
I thought it was awesome, especially coming off of the rest of the viral campaign. I think everything they've come out with for their viral campaign for Prometheus has been like above and beyond what they needed to do or what they had to do to appease fans. It kicked off with Guy Pearce and a really chilling TED Talk from the future that had just like a wonderful tag at the end of it that just made you go, ooh. And then we had a short clip from the David 8 thing coming out of WonderCon. And this one's like an extended version of that one. But I mean, instead of using the viral campaign as like focusing on like the 12th male lead from Prometheus and some kooky just like internet write-ups about things, they're putting out like pieces of like really well done material, like really, really well done videos that have been put together that are just amazing. I mean, and especially that they got Fassbender to come in and do all this extra work, it just like hypes up the anticipation even more.
Absolutely. Jason, what about you? What did you think of the fake commercial for the David 8?
I loved it. I thought it was really well done. Matt, to kind of extrapolate on what you were saying, the creepiness factor, the way that Fassbender just kept talking about efficiency and how he can make your organization more efficient really made me feel obsolete and made me kind of worry about, you know, the security of my own position. At any given time, Michael Fassbender could come in and definitely replace me. And that was a little scary, but also kind of what Adam was talking about. The TED Talk, the Guy Pearce video was really well done, also kind of unsettling. Some of the schematics that I think we've posted recently of like the ship and things like that. I mean, maybe engineering nerds will be all over that. Maybe that kind of goes over my head, but I can certainly appreciate the effort that they put into it. But kind of where I'm at right now with Prometheus is that, and I think I've said something to this end in the top five a few weeks back, is that you've got me, Ridley Scott. I don't need anything else to tell me that I need to go see this. Like, I want to go see it, and I certainly appreciate, you know, all the effort that they're going through and putting out these materials. And I think, like you guys have said, they're really well done. But I'm sold. You know, I don't need any more.
Yeah, the David 8 commercial, I loved it because it had sort of this, even though it's a future commercial, especially in the future, it had a very sort of 60s, 70s, you know, vibe to it. And yet at the same time, there was sort of a mix of, to be honest, of what I felt an Apple commercial would be. Like, he's like, I'm the David 8. And some guy comes on, it's like, and I'm the Gary 7. And the Gary 7 is John Hodgman and just shows him up. And David 8's like, I'll fill your office's handsome quotient and efficiently. And so the way it was made, just the style of it. And that style has nothing to do with how Prometheus will look like or anything like that, but it's another thing that draws us deeper into that world of Prometheus, and not just the plot, because the plot will be its own thing, but in a weird way, this viral campaign is writing a backstory for the movie, which is really cool. It's almost like we're getting a prequel in viral campaign form, and we haven't really seen this before. What do you all think about sort of what a viral campaign can do in terms of not just necessarily ratcheting up excitement for a film, but can it add anything to a movie, to the actual film? Jason, you mentioned sort of how they had already sold you. But in terms of viral campaigns overall, what did you think in terms of how much something sells you and then how much something actually draws you into the world of the movie?
Yeah, I think you make a really good point, Matt. I think good viral campaigns, and maybe this is kind of part of the bigger picture that that we want to talk about today. I think that a well-made, well-deployed viral campaign should be something that creates an investment in the world of the movie itself. And I think that's exactly what I've seen from Prometheus, that campaign so far. That's what it's doing. It's creating, like you said, a little bit of a backstory. And it's creating something that whenever I actually go to see the movie, even if the aesthetic is completely different, even if some of the things that I've seen previously from the viral campaign don't necessarily come into play and hit you over the head and say, hey, this was in the viral campaign, what it kind of does is it gives you an investment and it gives a sense of context so that you can kind of go back and you have a relationship with a David Eight or with, with Guy Pearce's character, with Weiland. Once you get into that movie, you already kind of have this established, you have an established familiarity with them and you kind of have an idea of what it is they're all about. And I think when you put that into the context of the film, that's only going to enhance the experience. And so I think in a way you're right. I think viral campaigns should go beyond just making Jason, myself, want to go see the movie. I think it should also be a payoff that even though I enjoy it right now, whenever I go see the movie, it should kind of enhance that enjoyment of the movie going experience. So I think they're doing everything right. And far be it from me to make any sort of suggestions as to how they should improve or do it better.
Okay, Adam, what about you? What are your thoughts on sort of the viral campaign as prequel / selling tool?
Well, I'm not really that big of like a viral campaign person. I'm too lazy and don't really have the patience to follow through on stuff. So it takes a lot to get me invested. But I thought the way this was executed, especially with that TED talk, it takes something familiar. I'm looking for something to draw me into that universe. And with no, like, they're not like, oh, look at this cool image that looks kind of like Prometheus, like follow the code to figure out I don't really want to sit around for 10 minutes trying to figure that out. But with the TED talk, it used something that everyone knows what a TED talk is. It drew me in, but it used this very well scripted speech by Guy Pearce to pull you into that universe and to say like, oh, in the world of Prometheus, this is what's going on. And I was instantly just like, I want to know more about that. And then they expanded on that with the David Eight stuff, saying like, this is what androids are like in that future. And this is basically just inviting you into that world, giving you a tease of what the universe of Prometheus is like. And I'm looking for something to tell me that I want to spend 2 hours in that universe and find out what else is going on. And I think this was executed perfectly in that it drew me into that universe as someone who's not a big fan of viral campaigns. It drew me into wanting to see more of the viral stuff. And it also acted as an invitation and kind of like a tease of this is, Prometheus is about this set of characters living in this world. And this is what that existence looks like. This is what that future is like. And do I want to spend more time in there? And I absolutely do.
See, one of the things Adam, you kind of briefly touched on this about how you don't want to spend 10 minutes just trying to dig for one little thing in a viral campaign. And one of the things that I think they've done really well with Prometheus is that they've just given you the stuff. For the TED talk, Damon Lindelof, the co-writer, just said, here's a link, watch this. And then Mashable posted the full David Eight commercial. And so all of that has just been given. And I totally agree that there some viral campaigns, they get so sucked into this decode this, make this, call that, put together all this string of information. Now, we did have codes as part of something to show sort of a David emotion or something like that, but that wasn't the thrust of it. For that stuff has been sprinkled in, but there are some viral campaigns where it's like every single step feels arduous. It almost feels like a job. It's like, will you please work hard so we can market this movie to you? Can you please just really put in the effort for us to show you ads?
Maybe you guys can remind me. Was it Battle Los Angeles that had kind of this extravagant viral marketing campaign where there, like Matt, like you were saying, you really had to go through the ringer to like get this information on the world of Battle Los Angeles and what was going on and kind of this pre-story and what was going on in the universe at the time when this movie was made. And I'm thinking, I don't care. Show me more things blowing up and or let's just move on. Like, I don't care about this. I don't need to figure out why Aaron Eckhart is doing this. I just don't. I need to see him screaming orders and, you know, maybe killing aliens. That's what I need.
Well, and also there's one thing to write, like you decode things to read, like you're reading journal entries from someone from that world. Like, I don't really want to sit here, read about someone I don't know, like the world of short
probably
films
may not even be in the movie. It's like background dude who like wrote something one day.
Yeah, but the world of short films is so like lends itself so well to this. Like, shoot me a 3-minute teaser of that world. Come up with something creative to show me that's gonna look really cool and that's gonna grab me so that I don't like I'm gonna gloss over if you're like enter these codes and read an 8-page diatribe journal entry from this person. Like, I don't know who this person is. I don't really know if I want to see this movie. Why do I want to read this? But throw a 2-minute video up there that looks cool, that grabs people's attention.
See, now, just to expand this, so the viral stuff, when we say viral, that actually can encompass a whole lot of things. Right now, we're just talking about a computer side. Everything where you don't have to leave your computer to sort of figure out the clues and get the next step. But another aspect of viral campaigns are alternate reality games, where you decode stuff and then have to leave your home. Shock, just the worst thing ever, having to leave and go outside and then hunt things down. You have to get in your car to go track down a promotions guy who will have a t-shirt and a code for you saying meet at this time. And so I was wondering, what do you guys think about that? Because that thing has been huge. For The Dark Knight, they did that, and that was nuts. And at the end of it, after this mammoth viral campaign, there was a reward at the end, and the reward was you can get tickets to see this movie early. I know that's like funny, but like, I mean, I don't know, if you're like a huge Dark Knight fan and someone's like, here's a free ticket to see it early. Sure. You know, I don't know. Maybe that's worth it to some people, but I don't know. Adam, what do you think about alternate reality games as part of a viral campaign? Are they worth the effort, and do they sell anyone?
I mean, I think it depends. Like, I mean, with Prometheus, they're showing these videos, but they also have the codes that you can enter in to get the images for the people. I mean, there are people that like doing that work. There are people that enjoy that. As far as the big alternate reality things where people have to leave their house, that's really hard to do on a movie that doesn't have a built-in audience. Like on a movie with The Amazing Spider-Man or The Dark Knight Rises, obviously there's going to be a lot of people interested to do that. But I don't know how you make that successful when introducing a brand to someone and saying like, hey, this will be worth your while to come out for this movie that you don't know about and that no one knows anything about.
I think Adam's exactly right. No, I don't mean to interrupt, Adam. Sorry, but I think you're absolutely right. I think something that has a built-in audience already. I mean, you could have a viral campaign where you tell someone to climb Mount Everest for a peek at Dark Knight Rises early.
And people like, would yes. do it. Yeah, they do it.
I need, like, not even the whole movie. Like, I need these first 5 minutes of the film. I am going to do this. Get out of my way. But you tell someone to do something like that for it. You know?
I'm sorry. My mind is just taken off about the Everest Dark Knight Rises campaign.
Absolutely.
My God. I'm sorry. Continue.
Sure. But like Adam was saying, you tell someone to do that for Battle Los Angeles and they're like, what? What's this movie? What? Didn't I get to watch Independence Day without doing all this work? Like, seriously?
Well, the other half of it is does it even work? Because, I mean, you guys make a very good point. It has to be something that people are already aware of, something Spider-Man, something Batman, something that already has a huge audience. Because Tron Legacy had a huge viral campaign. Massive. That film underperformed at the box office because Tron ultimately was 20 years old. And the first film flopped. It was still kind of a niche. It still was like a cult film, but they're like, we can build this into a franchise. But Batman and Spider-Man are already franchises to the point where it's almost like, why pay money for this viral campaign in the first place? I mean, how? That's sort of, you know, my other question. I don't know. I don't think we can come to a indisputable answer on this about, you know, we don't have the facts and figures about how effective a viral campaign is in driving ticket sales or building awareness. But at the same time, and I guess that's sort of my question, is this just something fun people can do, or does this help sell the film?
And maybe the studios are hoping like these kids running around town will end up on the local news, and so you have like people sitting at home going, what's the Dark Knight, what is this?
You know how it's going to end up on the local news if one of the viral campaign things is build a speed bump here. Build a speed bump in this neighborhood, or, I don't know, rob a liquor store. One of those two, it'll be, you know, that would actually be good for the Amazing Spider-Man. It's like, we need you to rob a liquor store, and you do it, and after, when you run out, Spider-Man punches you in the face. And you're like, yay, Amazing Spider-Man, July 3rd.
I think, Matt, to go to your point, and you're right, the three of us sitting here don't have facts and figures and anything that could provide evidence as to how powerful viral campaigning is to escalating box office numbers. But I'm assuming it has some sort of positive impact because it's been going on for a while, and it's something that seems to be only getting implemented more as we go forward. And the people with the facts and figures that do know are still deploying these things. So I would assume, I mean, the bottom line ultimately is box office take. It's the bottom line is the bottom line. It's the money. And so I'm assuming that it is helpful, but that's just me putting trust in industry players who maybe aren't deserving of my trust. Maybe they are. But to get to your point, I would say that it probably is helpful, or else they wouldn't be doing it, because I don't think they would be putting out these really well-made pieces, in the case of Prometheus, these really interesting ancillary artifacts, if you will, just for our enjoyment. It's never just about us enjoying something. There has to be purpose-driven.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully we'll be seeing more cool Prometheus stuff in the lead-up to the film's campaign, film's release. I'm sure we will. But let's move on to Netflix and Arrested Development. Now, for those who don't know, Arrested Development, people are like, we need a movie. And they're like, you're not just getting a movie, you're getting another fucking season. And people lost their shit over losing their shit again. And so there was a bidding war over a show that had been canceled, by the way. I just loved that. And Showtime, and who had the potential to rescue the show when it was dying, they're like, we want it now. But Netflix, which isn't a television station, they came in and they got it. They bought it, and everyone who was whining about Netflix raising their prices was like, well, shit, now I got to go get Netflix again for at least a month or so. Or they're like, oh, I'll get it for a few months, because like any TV series, there'll be a new episode once a week. Well, this week we learned no. Because Netflix doesn't have to abide by normal television, what we know of any television channel and how seasons normally air, Arrested Development Season 4 will air all of its 10 episodes at once, which almost means it's like a long movie, considering how closely Arrested Development episodes tie together. And so I was kind of curious on y'all's thoughts about this unique releasing strategy for such a highly anticipated show. So Jason, what did you think when you heard the news about season 4 airing all at once?
Well, I think it's interesting. And first, let me throw out this disclaimer, and this will probably, I won't be surprised if you guys disconnect me right now, but I have only watched the first season of Arrested Development.
Adam, what did you think of?
So I know that automatically puts my opinion way down on the totem pole, and that's fine. So I'm going to try and approach this kind of from the industry model, the way Netflix is going about doing this. And like I said, it interests me. The idea that they're going to be probably putting together, I would assume, a 220-minute long Arrested Development season that like Mitch Hurwitz said, he expects or would like for audiences to watch all in one fell swoop. I think that's interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing kind of how that's taken by the audience. I think ultimately Netflix is a great place for Arrested Development, and getting it off, obviously getting off of network and even, off network, your premium channels, your HBOs, your Showtimes, things where ratings do hold a little bit more water, because Netflix ultimately, 3 to 6 million is, I think, where the average was in rating for Arrested Development over the course of its life on Fox. An average rating, 3 to 6 million. On Netflix, if those numbers are there, that's not a big issue. I mean, that's something that, great, awesome. We have 3 to 6 million people watching this. It's not such a huge issue because you don't have to answer to advertisements and the things that, traditional network television has to answer to. So I think it's a great spot for Arrested Development. I think Netflix is, and I'm interested to see, how this goes forward.
Well, the other interesting thing about it is Netflix, because it's not a television station, doesn't have a schedule. There's nowhere to say, but they could do it. What I find curious about this whole, we're going to release it all at once. And the thing is, let's not forget, Netflix can, they have the rights to the season. They can decide, we're going to be like, no, we're not going to air it all at once. We're going to air it week by week, which to me would seem like the smart decision from their perspective, because if I want Netflix subscribers and I have 10 episodes of a show, well, shit, I can get a subscriber for 3 months. If I do that, someone has to renew their subscription if they want to keep watching Arrested Development. Or they can wait 3 months, and any self-respecting Arrested Development fan isn't going to wait 3 months for it to all be available. So I just find it strange, I guess is the best word, for releasing it all at one time. Adam, what about you? What do you think about this?
Well, it's a really, really interesting case for a couple of reasons. First of all, Netflix has already launched their first original series. It's called Lilyhammer with Steven Van Zandt. But they launched it all at once. Every single episode was on at once. So this seems to be their format and should be the format for House of Cards, which is the series that David Fincher is directing with Kevin Spacey on board. It's also interesting to note that this season of Arrested Development is more like a mini series. Each episode will be focusing on a different character.
Well, no. They changed that. He said that was where it started, but as he was writing it, it came more in line with how the series, the first three seasons. So now more like the original.
In that case, that's because I was assuming, if you're releasing them all at once, if they're separate vignettes, then that would make sense to release them all at once. You can watch them all in a row. But I watch a lot of TV on DVD and on Netflix, and I've noticed that the shows that you marathon, they're all kind of a blur. I mean, you really enjoy it and you can remember everything. But the thing about week-to-week programming is that there are episodes that stand out. Like, I remember watching the Suitcase episode of Mad Men last season, thinking it was the best episode of the series I've ever seen. If you're watching the show on DVD or anything and you're just blurring right past because you want to get to the next episode, I don't know how pronounced single episodes can be. I kind of try to – if I'm marathoning a show, I kind of try to keep track on Wikipedia of what I've – seen in episodes that have kind of, the episodes that were singled out for the Emmys and stuff. And so I can kind of slow down and realize, okay, how does this work as an episode of television and not as a whole of a season, which is essentially what you're doing when you're marathoning. You're watching a really long movie.
Well, see, to me, it just depends on the show. I would say don't marathon Mad Men because it's just not that kind of show. It's a show where you watch an episode and you let it sink in and you let it simmer. Whereas a show like, even though I don't think it's a good show, 24 has it both ways. It can be a show where it's like, what's going to happen next week? But you can breeze through it on DVD, which is how it became really popular, is because of DVD. People picked up that show and they're like, they tore through it because it has that momentum to it. So some shows, I think, lend themselves to marathons. For Arrested Development, I think the marathon aspect of it works well because it's a show where you'd probably go back and rewatch it anyway. Right, you'd watch the second episode air and then you'd go back to episode one because it's a show where things keep tying into each other. There's so many in jokes, and I think that's one of the things that sunk Arrested Development when it was on the air, because there were not a lot of entry points for new viewers. It's a show that kept building on itself. And because DVD hadn't really taken a foothold, because there wasn't digital downloads or streaming platforms for it, people just couldn't find that access point. But now, obviously, things are different. So for me, I think the marathon, the airing all the episodes at once, strange business decision for Netflix. But as a fan, I think this is ideal. I think it works well, not just because I'm a Arrested Development fan and I'm greedy and I want it all at once, but because it suits this show.
Yeah, I think. Oh, sorry, Adam, you can go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say I would agree because, I mean, and even watching the shows back on DVD, there were so many callbacks that just breeze right past it. I didn't catch the show on TV when it was airing. I watched it on DVD. And stuff that I don't know if I would remember if I was watching week to week something from season one that comes up in season three.
And I think it'll be interesting to just kind of take a step back and look at this as a whole kind of a test as to see how our audience is going to receive this. It looks like, Matt, I think you make a good point that from a business decision, it is maybe not what you would expect. But I think Netflix has made it pretty clear that we're not a television station, nor are we going to try to be one outside of providing content that you may typically have seen on television. And so I think they're kind of going about it, marching, I guess, to their own beat here. And I think I'll be interested to look back and kind of look at it as a whole picture down the road and see, okay, how did audiences receive this? Was this successful? And see how that kind of directs the trajectory of Netflix programming going forward, because this isn't going to be the lone example of this. You know, Netflix is going to be moving forward, and I would expect to see other things, other shows going that way, whether they be original or shows that fell off the network wagon.
Absolutely. Well, you're right. I definitely will be interested to see where this is going. Let's move on with our last news-related topic to the 2012 Cannes Film Festival, which announced its full lineup this week. Now, we knew Moonrise Kingdom would be the opening film, but there were other films that we were pretty sure were going to be in the lineup, like on the Walter Salles adaptation of On the Road and Cosmopolis, David Cronenberg's Cosmopolis. But there were also some other nice confirmations: John Hillcoat's new film Lawless, formerly The Wettest County, but I would say, as far as something that was on the fence, Andrew Dominik's Killing Them Softly, which is the horrible new title for what was originally called Kogan's Trade, and then The Paperboy, Lee Daniels' The Paperboy. Lee Daniels, for those who may not recognize his name, was the director of Precious. So all in all, I think this is an exciting lineup for Cannes. And I think also what's interesting when they announce the Cannes lineup is what isn't in the mix, what film is probably finished but is being held. So, for instance, Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, there was sort of this fingers crossed, maybe we'll see it at Cannes, but now it looks like the film will be held until the fall film festival circuit. So, Jason, what about you? What did you think when you heard, what do you think of this year's lineup for Cannes?
I think a lot of the titles you mentioned, I'm definitely excited to hear. Obviously, I'm not going to be there, unfortunately, but I'm always excited.
Why not?
I know.
Like, just take a bus.
I should just show up and be like, I'm Jason with Collider.
I'm Jason. You didn't give your last name. I'm Jason. I can just imagine you like pointing to yourself with your thumb. Like, I'm Jason. Let me in.
Absolutely. I came all this way and I'm going to write stuff about this. So you should let me in for free. Where's the soda? That's
what I was saying. They're going to love you on the Christmas.
Yeah, I'll let you guys know how that turns out.
I bet it works splendidly.
Absolutely. I mean, in the meantime, there's definitely some titles that I'm interested in seeing more than others. The Lawless, which I also preferred the Wettest County title as well. I kind of preferred that over. And just the same with Kogan's Trade. I definitely prefer that over Killing Them Softly, but I digress. I'm excited to see that. Obviously, there's a really great cast on display, and that's something that anytime Tom Hardy's in anything right now, he's such a kind of a hot actor, and not in just in terms of his abilities and in the range he can provide. I think I'm interested to see that. Cosmopolis is probably number one for me in terms of most anticipated. I'm a big Cronenberg fan, and this looks to be just as kind of perverse and crazy as I would hope to see from Cronenberg. I'm kind of excited to see Robert Pattinson in that. Based on what I've seen so far, it looks like it could be a nice change in direction for him. I always hate to see people get kind of boxed in and typecast, and I feel like, not that he's an amazing actor, and I haven't seen anything that's really changed my ideas of him, but I like to see people maybe be able to branch out a little bit. Maybe this will help him shed the Edward Cullen weight that he kind of carries around.
Shed that character. you watch interviews with him. He is so happy to just be like, I'm glad this launched my career. Let me out.
Yeah, like, I'm glad I'm super rich now, but I would like to do other things. And so I'm excited to see if that would work for him. And so that's kind of where I'm at. Another entry here that I'm just kind of looking through the list that I'm interested in seeing, and this is just me being a horror fan, I'm kind of interested in seeing the reception for Dario Argento's Dracula 3D. I'm a big fan, not of any recent work, but anytime you have, you know, some iconic works like he's done in the past with Suspiria and Deep Red, etc., you know, I'm interested to see his take on that. I'm not expecting big things, but as a horror fan, I am excited to hear how that turns out.
Adam, what about you? What's grabbing your attention from this year's Cannes?
Quite a bit. I mean, I think the lineup is pretty exciting. I'm probably most excited for Killing Them Softly. Director Andrew Dominik's The Assassination of Jesse James was one of my favorite movies of the last decade. So I'm really, really interested to see that one. It's got an incredible cast. I mean, you got Brad Pitt, Richard Jenkins, James Gandolfini. And I'm excited to see what Dominic does in the world of kind of crime. Brad Pitt plays a mob enforcer. And I'm also kind of surprisingly excited for The Paperboy. I appreciated Precious. It's not a very exciting movie to watch when you feel happy.
It's laugh a minute.
Feel good movie of the century.
I needed quite the pick me up after that one. But again, I think the cast, I mean, Matthew McConaughey is having like a creative or like a career renaissance right now with some amazing roles. He's in that one. You got Nicole Kidman, John Cusack plays a death row inmate, Zac Efron plays a driver. But I'm interested to hear how that is. Also Lawless, I think that has a great cast too, and I like all the stuff surrounding that. And as Jason said, Cosmopolis looks exciting and fucking crazy based on those trailers. As far as what's not there, I was kind of hoping to see The Master there, but I'm not surprised they're holding it. A film like that may or may not be about Scientology. I just feel like kind of the controversy could get too big for that movie. If it's released this early, it could kind of encapsulate
that. Well, the Weinstein Company is distributing it. They love controversy. So if that's the case, they're gonna run with that. So
obviously.
That's how all their marketing campaigns work, is mostly controversy.
Yeah, you saw Bully.
I did see Bully, but not because of the marketing campaign.
I was also kind of disappointed to see that Terrence Malick, The Burial, isn't there. That's one that he shot back in 2010 with Ben Affleck and Rachel McAdams. And I was kind of hoping it would show up as a surprise at like The Tree of Life did last year, just so that would mean that we're seeing it sometime soon, seeing as how he's shooting two movies this summer. I don't anticipate that I'll have a lot of time to keep doing post-production on that. So I hope we hear that it's finished soon so it doesn't linger for another 2 years.
But that's the Malick way. You don't finish it. If a movie takes more than 5 years to complete, is it really finished? No. You got to spend at least 5 years per movie. So I don't care that he's shooting two at one time. We'll see seeing those in 2017 and 2022 and 2018. He's going to be around for a while, is what I'm saying. I would just like to finish up. I mean, there's definitely films I'm looking forward to on this list. I think it's important to remember the breakout film could be the one we don't know. It could be, and the performer could be the guy we haven't heard of. No one in America knew who Christoph Waltz was until he won Best Actor for Inglourious Basterds. And furthermore, Inglourious Basterds that played at Cannes was not the version we got. That had some cuts made to it. So the versions of these movies that show over there may not be precisely what we get over here. But I would also just more recently, The Artist rose to attention because Jean Dujardin, is that, I'm just gonna say his last name that way. I don't care.
I think it's perfect.
Right on. He won Best Actor. So, and the Weinstein Company picked up the film there. And so I would say, we have our eye on the films we've heard of, the films with the name directors and the stars. We have our eye on those movies, but we should also just, I'm excited for what people are going to say about the films we don't know anything about. I think that's one of the best parts of film festivals is here's a film you knew nothing about and now everyone's talking about it. For instance, at Sundance, people didn't know Beasts of the Southern Wild. People went nuts over it at Sundance, and actually that movie will be playing at Cannes. Another example in this awesome segue I'm about to make, at last year's Toronto Film Festival, no one knew what The Raid was, and that film drove people, they went nuts, and everyone else was like, I don't have time to see this in my first 2 days here, and they were like, we're not going to reshow it. And so we waited, and thankfully they showed it at Sundance, and now everyone has a chance to see it. Unless, except Jason, who lives in Southern Illinois, and that's not a real place. So it is expanding, though, because it is finding an audience. It expanded to your neck of the woods, Adam. So I've seen it twice. You've seen it. Let's talk about The Raid, begrudgingly, Redemption. I'm just going to call it The Raid throughout all of this. But Adam, my review is on the site. So what did you think about the film?
I liked it. For those who don't know, it takes place in the slums of Jakarta. It's basically, there's this apartment building that's run by a crime lord, and it's infested with murderers and killers and gangsters. They're all renting out apartment rooms there. And there's a 20-man SWAT team that's sent in to raid the apartment complex. What ensues is lots of gunplay, lots of fist fighting, lots of blood, lots of action. I'm not exactly a martial arts connoisseur, but I really liked it. I enjoyed it. The story was, it was good. It was serviceable enough to get you through. You cared enough about these characters that you didn't want them to die or perish. The fight scenes were absolutely insane. And, I love the way writer director Gareth Evans set all of them up so that you weren't watching the same action scene play out time after time after time. Each action sequence has a different setting, a different feel, a different kind of fight. I mean, you've got guns, you've got knives, fist fighting, one on two, two on one, four on four. And the martial arts that these guys perform is absolutely insane. I would like this to be like required viewing for anyone trying to make an action movie from now on in America. And instead of relying on just wire work and CGI and explosions, you don't need all of that. All you need is a story that has you care about these characters, and then just some insane action sequences that play out.
Well, I'm sorry, continue.
I was just saying I really liked it.
See, I wouldn't say that I cut you off again. I'm sorry. I have to respond to a point with the all action movies should do this. I think some action movies should do this. Should in terms of melee combat. I think that's where this movie has it down. You know, I wouldn't say everyone, you know, if you're making something with space battles, probably don't take a page from The Raid. But
well, I'm just saying cut back on the visual, on relying on visual effects to get you through everything, to cutting to a wide shot and just have these CGI'd people doing whatever it is they do just because it was too complicated to do or you didn't want to stage it out.
Absolutely. Although it's worth mentioning that these fights took like a year and a half choreograph and execute. And so I think this leads to an interesting point regarding what can action movies do, because The Raid is not the most expensive movie ever made, and it's not packed with special effects. It's in terms of CG, it's all very practical, and yet that took its own time to plan. So what we're seeing is, I mean, you're totally right, Adam, that people throw in just CG and like that's the end of the day. But at the same time, it's like for that budget, we're looking at bigger budgets. And does that necessarily make a better action film? And I would say The Raid is a reminder that no, that is not necessarily the case.
I think I'm gonna pipe in here, the guy that didn't
how dare
see the
you? Quiet, oh, no. You and your one season of Arrested Development. Why did we even let you join us? I'm sorry, go on.
I just lost my movie blogger certification, and that took me a whopping 2 weeks to get. And
well,
so...
it's okay, because you can just show up at Cannes and be like, I'm Jason. Can I have a soda and watch movies?
You laugh like that's a joke, but that's really going to happen. Okay. So you're talking about kind of the budget of an action movie and what it needs to be a good action movie. An element of the film that I've heard a lot about that, having not seen it, I would like for you guys to talk about and maybe discuss how that plays in, is the soundtrack, or the score, I should say. You know, Mike Shinoda, Linkin Park. I would be interested in hearing, you know, how that plays into the film and if that gives it a certain element or a certain swag, if you will.
Matt, did you see both versions? Did you see it with the Linkin Park score and with the original score?
No, they brought in the Linkin Park score once it was at Sundance. Only the people at Toronto saw it without it. It's not really the Linkin Park score, really. I mean, it's one of their members.
Yeah, he contributed.
I think it's fine. I don't know. I haven't heard any complaints from anyone who saw it at Toronto saying the new score is terrible. I think it's fine. I think it's serviceable. I don't walk out of the raid, though, thinking, like, man, that score was awesome.
Sure.
That's not high on my list in terms of things I remember about the movie. I remember machetes. That's sure. what I remember about the movie.
So you would say, like, the choreography and things like that stuck with you more so than maybe a score.
Right. I mean, not just the fight choreography, but the cinematography, because it's not just wide shot. There is editing involved. The thing is, though, is I'm going to keep my camera steady when it needs to be steady, shaky when I need to shake it, and I'm going to edit to augment the action rather than trying to cover things up or just this sort of the let's peg every bad action thing on Michael Bay, even though I think he makes good action, you know, exciting action movies. But this notion of quick cutting, where I can't hold any shot longer than 7 seconds or I'll die. So for the rate, you know, Evans knows how long to, is that it? Gareth Evans? I would get him and
yeah, I think
it is right. Evans. Cause I was about to say, who is it? Edwards? No, Edwards directed Monsters. But back to the raid, he knows how long to hold a shot to keep the tension. And then when to cut it to make that punch or slice or stab really, you know, hit hard. Mm-hmm. So I would say, Adam, I'm sorry, go on.
And in keeping with kind of like what can action directors learn from The Raid to better action movies from now on, Evans basically teaches a class saying, like, here's one way to do a kill, here's another way to do a kill, here's a different way of doing a kill. And it's just everything, he has a bunch of different ways of showing how someone is killed. And they all, I'm thinking specifically at the very beginning, I don't want to give anything away, but there's a kill that isn't shown on screen, but the way that is done, it just kind of caught my eye, and the way they followed the person performing the kill with the camera, I thought was really, really cool and really interesting. It was something that I thought, wow, I haven't really seen that before, or I haven't seen that in a long time.
Yeah, I would say that in terms of the story, I mean, the action is why you see this movie. If you love action films, and especially those kind of action movies where you're just cheering because it just sates your bloodlust so much. If you like those kind of action movies, absolutely. I would say the story is just enough to get you there. Like, it's like, the main action hero, the guy on the SWAT team, I don't know if he's a rookie or not. I don't think he's just a guy, but he's the one who knows martial arts like crazy. He's the best martial artist on the team. His name, I'm just going to credit this guy because he did such an amazing job. Iko Uwais. I hope I just didn't butcher his name, but he's sort of the lead. He's the lead character. But you know, in the first scene, we see him, you know, he has a pregnant wife, and I'm like, oh god. You know, it's like, of course, it's like, I just don't have a wife, I have a wife with a kid on the way, I better not die because I have so much to live for. And I would like to see the other 19 guys on the squad who just they leave their sad, darkened apartments with like tears in their eyes. And they'll be like, yep, here's another day with nothing to live for. All right. Time to go to work. Because I mean, it's definitely that very bare story to just like a skeleton. It's like I need something to move the plot along, and it does give you enough reason to care about him and what he's going through. And I would also say the performances, the team leader, Jaka, who's played by Joe Taslim, I thought he was just gave a really sympathetic performance. You don't know, you know, who's waiting for him at home, but he's just feels like a really responsible dude who cares about his guys and doesn't want to see them slaughtered or anything like that. He just feels like that really responsible commander. And yeah, that's a stock character, but I think the actor does a good job with it. Okay, so now that we've talked about the raid, let's move on to our recommendations. Jason, since you are our guest here, why don't you start with your recommendation for the week?
Sounds wonderful. I appreciate you guys having me. I know this is kind of Dave's thing, but I appreciate being able to step in. So I just wanted to get that in. So I'm going to very loosely tie. I know we like to kind of tie things into the topics we've talked about. And you guys get ready for this degree of separation. We talked about Cannes today. Cannes in France, right? So I am giving a French film my recommendation for the
Holy
week.
Holy shit, that is a stretch.
Yep. Read them and weep, boys. Read them and weep. Okay. So what I'm going to recommend is 2002's He Loves Me, He Loves Me Not, directed by, and I'm probably going to ruin everyone's name in describing this, but I hope they'll forgive
Welcome
me.
Welcome to the Collision, where we can't pronounce the names of foreigners.
We're dumb Americans.
We really are.
We truly are.
Oh,
continue.
Directed by Letitia Columbani, 2002, it stars Audrey Tautou, who... probably North American audiences maybe know her better from Da Vinci Code. She was alongside Tom Hanks. She also was in Amelie, which was, I think, 2001. Had some Oscar nods there. But 2002, He Loves Me, He Loves Me Not. This is kind of – it's kind of a romantic comedy facade, and lying underneath it is kind of a psychological thriller. I don't know if either of you have seen the film.
No, I have not.
Okay. So the film begins as what kind of seems like this really pretty, very, very lovey-dovey romantic story. And Audrey Tautou plays an art student named Angelique. And she begins the film kind of getting a rose, and she's delivering it to what you think is her boyfriend, and or what the movie presents as her boyfriend, and everything seems very nice. And she kind of the story gets told that she is she's pursuing this guy, and what seems like a very nice love story quickly takes kind of a turn in a complete U-turn in the opposite direction, and kind of nothing is as it seems. I don't want to give away too much because I think a lot of the value in the movie is kind of seeing the way things go. I will say that kind of midway through the movie, you get kind of a complete rewind back to the beginning, similar to, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Run Lola Run, the German.
Indeed.
Yeah, absolutely. So you get kind of a complete reset about midway through the movie, where you see this love story being told, not from Audrey Tautou's point of view, but from this man that she's pursuing, this person you think is her love interest. And so lots of twists and turns take place, and it kind of turns the whole romantic feel on its head, and it quickly kind of spirals down into this deep, dark delving into erotomania and mental illness in a way that only the French could. So my recommendation for the week would be He Loves Me, He Loves Me Not.
Okay, right on. Adam, what do you got for us?
Seeing as how we spoke about the Cannes Film Festival and Terrence Malick's new film is not in the festival, I'm going to recommend Malick's 1978 film Days of Heaven. It stars a very, very young Richard Gere as a manual laborer in 1916 Chicago who knocks down and kills a boss in a steel mill. I'm not really giving anything away. This is the very first scene in the movie. And so he flees with his girlfriend and his younger sister to the Texas Panhandle, and they find work on a farmer's farm, seasonal work. And a love triangle ensues with the sickly farmer slash owner, played by Sam Shepard, and Richard Gere's girlfriend, who he tells everyone that they're brother and sister to avoid gossip and rumors and such. Malick shot the film mostly during magic hour, which, if you're not familiar, is the 20 minutes or so just before sunrise and just after sunset, where the sun isn't in the sky, but there's still light filling the sky. And it's absolutely the most gorgeous movie I've ever seen in my life. Every shot is just like a work of art. And it was actually shot in Canada, but it looks very much like the Texas Panhandle. Just sweeping grass and this lovely mansion that Sam Shepard lives in. They built the full mansion because Malick likes to shoot kind of improvisationally. He likes to go where he wants with the camera. And so they shot it 360 degrees. They built the mansion to be able to shoot in it 360 degrees. And so just everything about the movie is beautiful. Has two cinematographers, because Malick was running so long that the first cinematographer had to leave the picture to go shoot another movie. And if you haven't seen it, I'm sure everyone's heard of it, but if you haven't seen it, I mean, it should be required viewing for all cinephiles or burgeoning film lovers. I know some younger people are averse to going back to older films, but I can guarantee you that this is just a wonderful work of art. It's a romantic drama, great performances. It's all told from the point of view of Richard Gere's younger sister. So it has a really interesting twist on point of view and what that means and how a story can be told using a different point of view, but not flat out pointing out like this is her point of view. So all the events kind of unfold. And it's right now it's on Netflix Instant Watch for your viewing pleasure, and it's also available if you have Epix HD, the channel. I prefer catching it in HD if you can, just for the beauty of it, but it's my favorite movie of Malick's by far, and definitely think you guys should check it out.
Hey, Adam, going back to making fun of Malick for taking a long time on his movies, how long did it take to edit Days of Heaven?
I think it took 2 years.
Over 2 years to edit the movie.
They could have made 7 Hunger Game installments in that amount of time.
Yes. I would also like to take a chance to point out that we could have talked about Hunger Games this week, and we didn't, because we have had 4 episodes, and we would have gone 4 for 4 talking about the Hunger Games, and we need it. Francis Lawrence is directing it. He's a journeyman director. It's probably going to be boring. Moving on. I mean, that's really... Fuck, we just talked about Hunger Games. Damn it! Now it is 4 for 4. All right, I'm going to move on to my recommendation. My recommendation is Rikkyo, The Story of Rikki, because like The Raid, it is an Asian action flick. It's not really a martial arts film, even though there is fighting in it. The Raid has choreography and very tight action. Rikkyo is just this low budget, really gross movie, like the sort of really cartoonish bloody violence where it's like, yes, we know this is a dummy, but we filled his head with jelly and fake and plastic, and he's made of latex, and it looks horrible, but it's so funny because it's playing it straight, and yet at the same time it's like, oh, this has to be parody, but none of the actors it is one of those films like, oh, is it serious, is it not? And it doesn't matter, to be honest, because it cracks me up no matter what. I've only watched the movie dubbed. I could watch it with subtitles, but to me that would not be as good, because in the first 5 minutes, here's what's happened. You have this guy named Rikki, and he gets sent to a prison, and it's the film set in the future, and all the prisons have been privatized. So he gets sent to a prison for killing the drug dealer that killed his girlfriend or whatever. It doesn't matter. So he goes in, and he's going through the metal detector, and they're like, he sets it off, and they do like an X-ray on him, and it's like... what set it off is his body is filled with bullets. And they're like, why didn't you let it? It's like, why didn't you have them take the bullets out? And Rikki just turns to them and goes, souvenirs, and just keeps walking. And so the plot of the film, and it's such just an excuse for gory, awful things to happen, is Rikki gets in, and the prison is run by this corrupt assistant warden, and this is even more corrupt warden, and basically there's this thing called the Gang of Four, where they run the different wings of the prison, the north, south, east, west wings of the prison complex, and Ricky stirs up shit by killing people, and then like, we have to kill you because you killed this guy, and we're gonna get you. And Ricky just keeps killing people, and everyone's like, he's making trouble. And there's just so much weird stuff in the movie as well. Like, the assistant warden, he has a fake eye, which he takes out with his hook hand at one point, opens it, and in his fake eye, he keeps breath mints. And which he just eats one, and he's like, would you like a mint from my fake eye? It's that kind of lunacy that just I absolutely adore, and it's so over the top. There's this... Did either of you guys watch The Daily Show when Craig Kilborn was the host before Jon Stewart?
I do remember those days.
You remember those days? All right. You remember Five Questions?
Yes.
Do you remember the video that played before Five Questions of the guy getting his head smashed?
Yes.
That's from Riccio.
Yeah.
It is. Memories. I highly recommend checking it out. And now we're doing a new thing now where we're going to have trailers for the movies we recommend. We're going to put those after the jump when we post our podcast. So that's this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. This one is filled with fun technical errors. I think we're going to have to break it into three parts. It's times like these where I'm like, maybe I should get a Mac with GarageBand. This would probably be a lot easier, but I don't. So we're going to keep freewheeling it, but you guys have sent me some really great tips on podcasting software that I'm going to start going through. We're also working on getting this thing finally on iTunes. It technically is on iTunes, connected to our RSS feeds, but it doesn't have like cover art or any of that good stuff. We're fixing that up. So we know, you know, technically where we're coming up short, but I want to assure you that we are working on it. Thank you to everyone who's listening. It seems that the response has been pretty positive, that we're at least entertaining you, which makes me happy. And I'm still having fun doing this. And I'm really glad, Jason, that you could be our first guest on the show.
Anytime, guys. Thank you.
And your excursion to Cannes, I can't wait to hear about that and all the soda you got and movies they wouldn't let you into. And so I'm having so much fun with this. And thank everyone for listening. Please leave your comments in the comments section to let us know how we can make the show better, what you liked about the show, what you didn't like about the show, and we're eager to hear it. Next week, we will be talking about The Pirates, Band of Misfits, and the five-year engagement, and whatever other news breaks, hopefully not Hunger Games news. For the love of God, can we go 1 week without Hunger Games news? But I doubt it, because they're putting that on a fast track and whatever. We're going to talk about what breaks. Hopefully there's some good stuff. And thank you for joining us. You can follow this podcast at CollisionCast. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Jason, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Collider Jason.
All right. Follow all of us. Follow this podcast and tune in next week. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, guys.